This one lay.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
An unusual attack has taken place in Afghanistan. Days ago, a suicide attack hit the Russian embassy there, killing two Russian staff members. This was the first strike on the diplomatic mission since the Taliban regained control. It was claimed by the Daesh Khorasan, or Daesh group, but why was the Russian embassy targeted? That's the key question. Is there a connection behind this attack with the U.S. in any shape or form? Who is on a war footing with Russia in Ukraine? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether there is a U.S. Al-Qaeda or Daesh connection. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Judith Fellow, senior member of United National Anti-War Movement, joins us from Rochester, New York. Also joining us, Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken Stone, let me first start with you and find out from you if you have an explanation as to why there would be an attack on the Russian embassy in Afghanistan where two Russian staff members were killed, the first strike on a diplomatic mission since the Taliban regained control.
Well, we need to note that ISIS, Daesh, claimed responsibility for the attack, and we know from history that ISIS is a U.S. asset. It was created by the U.S. in order to, two reasons, to destabilize the government of Syria in the U.S. attempt at regime change there, which failed. And it's also provided a pretext for the U.S. to remain in Syria to this day and also in Iraq. So, and we know that the U.S. is the main backer of ISIS because as early as 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency said that the U.S. welcome or would welcome the creation of the Islamic State. And both Vice President Biden years ago and along with former Secretary of State John Kerry both let the cat out of the bag in various public speeches, which were televised for the whole world to see, saying that ISIS was indeed a U.S. asset. Now, it's merely speculation at this point, but if it was indeed ISIS which conducted this horrible terrorist attack on the Russian embassy, killing people who were lined up trying to get visas, that is to say Afghani people, plus two members of the staff of the Russian embassy, then we can, knowing that ISIS is indeed asset of the U.S., we can speculate that it's part of the U.S. plan to destabilize the new government of Afghanistan. They have withheld, they have frozen the Afghan monetary resources. They have refused to send food aid and other aid to the starving people of Afghanistan. They have encouraged other countries not to recognize the new government, and the U.S. has not recognized the new government. The Russian government was one of the few countries that did have open diplomatic relations with the new government in Kabul, and perhaps this is the way the U.S. is sending a message to Russia and to the rest of the world. We are not happy with the new government. We don't want you to set up diplomatic missions in Kabul, and this might happen to you next.
All right. Well, Judith Bellow, if you agree with what our guest there, Ken Stone, has said, then would you in turn or by default agree that the stage then is set for these Daesh terrorists, or IS Khorasan, as some call them, to operate then and act on behalf, and given Ken Stone's association there of it being a U.S. asset, to act on behalf of, let's say, foreign governments, in this case the U.S., inside Afghanistan? And what would the gains be?
Well, I do think that Ken has made some very good points. And I think there is another aspect in which this event shows the U.S. Initiative and their intention moving forward. Because right now, the proxy war in Ukraine is losing badly. So the United States has a major investment in a war against Russia where their proxy is going to lose. So they need to have ways to mitigate this outcome. And one way to do that is to open up conflict on other fronts against the Russians. So recently there have been a lot of attacks in Syria. There have been attacks by Israel and also by the United States against Syrian military and also civilian sites. And there have also been attacks so there's also this attack now coming up in Afghanistan, and Pakistan is also under threat. They have lost their president and are suffering a terrible natural disaster at this point. But I think that the loss of a president who opposed U.S. policy is significant here, because it's another way in which Afghanistan is being destabilized. And this is a problem for the Russians. They cannot commit a lot of resources to dealing with it, but they can't not be aware of it. So it puts them really in a dilemma here. In Syria, people are quite concerned, actually, and they're going, why are the Russians not helping us more? And, of course, the Russians really need to keep their resources focused in Ukraine at this moment. And now they have a situation in Afghanistan where, again, people are saying, well, what are the Russians going to do? And they are in no position at this moment to mount a major response to this. Uh-huh. So it's going to be interesting to see how international diplomacy, because the Russians certainly aren't alone, they are allied with the Chinese. They have support from other Asian countries, including India. How are they going to deal with this issue? And I think this is going to decide the outcome, really. Going forward, it's going to decide the world order going forward, because if the Russians were defeated somehow in Ukraine, the only way that could possibly happen is if they change their focus and moved it to something else. So obviously they can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at what a year and a half ago, Kent Stone, the Russian president, said, of which it echoed also some other sources, not echoed, but it was... relayed in other sources, and that is that Putin said fighters with experience are being attracted from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan for military operations. He said at a meeting with the heads of the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, he called them fighters, but these are terrorists. First of all, how are they being transported? How are they making it there? Who's behind that? And what? Why is that something that is being done at this point?
Well, I mentioned earlier the ISIS and al-Nusra and all the alphabet soup of terrorist organizations inside of Syria are proxy warriors for the U.S. They were recruited, financed, and supported, inserted into Syria in order to defeat the Syrian government as part of U.S. foreign policy. And at the various times that these ISIS fighters were defeated, such as at Raqqa and other places, the U.S. Rounded up the survivors and shipped them off to different bases, including the Al-Tanf base inside of Syria, where there have been three or four attacks recently. Right. And they intend to recycle these fighters and ship them off to other sites, such as Afghanistan, in order to continue the work of the United States in destabilizing governments that it finds are not compliant to its needs. I want to point out that Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president of Syria, famously said that the French started organizing for the return to Syria the day after they were kicked out of the country. And that is exactly what the U.S. intends to do with Afghanistan. They have not given up after the debacle of last August when they left with their tails between their legs. Uh-huh. They intend to come back into Afghanistan, and this is one means by which they intend to do so.
Well, let's see here. Before I go and turn to Judith Bellow, I'd like to follow her train of thought here. Kent Stone, Judith Bellow talked about how Russia is going to react to what is happening in Afghanistan, and the president Putin has said about how he is watching closely these Daesh fighters. Are we looking at a scenario where the purpose that the U.S. has in mind maybe is to try to draw and attract Russia, and not just Russia, into the war scenario in Afghanistan, but also perhaps to draw Iran into this? Because we know that these Daesh terrorists are no friends of Iran, obviously. And, well, it seems like they're not either on the same page as the Taliban, or they have, I'm not too sure what kind of relationship they do have. That's something to also ask you. But do you think that that is perhaps one of the intentions, drawing in Russia and Iran maybe through creating instability in Afghanistan? Ken Stone.
Thank you. The United States is on the warpath all over the world at the moment. They are ratcheting up tensions in Taiwan with Pelosi's visit. They are ratcheting up tensions in Kosovo when they tried to take away the rights of the Serb residents there. They are ratcheting up tensions in Estonia and in Lithuania with Kaliningrad. And with Iran, they are ostensibly trying to re-enter the JCPOA. But just a week or two ago, the U.S. attacked several bases inside of Syria that they claimed were being used by Iran. Iran denied that they were using these bases, but Iran has the right to be has been invited to help Syria as an ally in the fight against Daesh, ISIS. In fact, the glorious martyr, General Soleimani, was the leader of the Iranian general, was the leader of the entire fight by the Axis of Resistance against Daesh, and it was a successful fight. But when the U.S. Attacks these bases in Syria, at the time that negotiations are going on about the JCPOA, uh-huh, it leads us to think that the U.S. really doesn't want to have a good permanent relationship with Iran. It's stirring up trouble there as well.
Sure. Well, Judith Bellow, let's see here. I'm still not sure how these terrorists are making their way from either their bases or wherever they're stationed at in Iraq or in Syria to Afghanistan. Tell us if perhaps one of the purposes that they are going to serve there, if they are a U.S. asset especially, is to try to engage Iran and Russia and create instability in Afghanistan in order to have those two countries, since they've cooperated together in Syria, to then be involved in Afghanistan.
I believe that you're correct, that they are trying to draw Iran and Russia into a conflict. It is the one way they can bleed their adversaries in the region. But I think that as far as transporting the fighters, the main thing is they have to say, get them out of Syria, which is pretty easy to do. But I think that the people that are actually paying for them to move around, because once they're not in Syria, they can fly just like anybody else somewhere. So they basically need to get them out of Syria and then transport them to someplace near Afghanistan, for instance, Pakistan. And that is where the situation in Pakistan becomes interesting, because they drove out a president who refused to allow them basing in Pakistan, who refused to support any of their initiatives in the Afghan war, and who refused to even support overflights by drones. So now they need a way to move these people from Syria, for instance, or Libya. They're in Libya too still, to move them into Afghanistan. And one of the ways, say, from Turkey.
All right. Yeah, unfortunately, you're breaking up a little bit there, Judith Bellow. Let me move on to Kent Stone. Kent Stone, so you talked about how the U.S. Is actually keen to maybe get back into Afghanistan. If we're looking at that scenario, we haven't mentioned one country here, and that's China. Are we looking at the fact that the U.S. also, if your assessment there is correct, wants to then use Afghanistan as a launching pad then against China? But then, you know, when that's presented, if you agree, it doesn't go with logic, where U.S. would then be engaged in so many military fronts. Not too sure how he's going to be able to, or you could say, if it's going to be able to execute all these different war scenarios.
The U.S. has a hegemonic agenda. It intends to dominate the world. It can't face up, the U.S. leaders just can't accept the fact that we are now in a multipolar world, where they are no longer the sole superpower and can tromp around the world, squashing whomever they want. So they are in a sort of desperate and reckless mode in which they are creating tensions everywhere, as I mentioned before, concerning China by sending Pelosi to Taiwan. And in Canada, a liberal MP is leading a delegation next month to Taiwan as well. It's all part of a game of ratcheting up tensions. It may have to do with domestic consumption in the states in the lead up to midterm elections. It may have to do with creating instability, which is good for the U.S. because in an unstable situation in any given region or country, they can play one side against another, and they can sell arms to all sides. So it's very profitable. Instability is very useful to the U.S. of A. And that's what they're doing in Afghanistan. They tried before, just the way that they're using ISIS now, in my opinion. They used the Taliban before and Al-Qaeda. They used Al-Qaeda before to create incidents to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan and to bring Afghanistan into their orbit. Now that they've lost Afghanistan, they're using ISIS to try and bring it back. And they're destabilizing, they're trying to destabilize Afghanistan, uh-huh. but all the countries around it by destabilizing Afghanistan. China and Russia and Iran have done their best to stabilize Afghanistan, bring it back into the international community and help the people of Afghanistan while the U.S. is causing trouble and deliberately starving the people of Afghanistan.
Well, here's the deal, Judith Pello, that it's somewhat confusing, to say the least, about the role that the Taliban is playing in all of this. We forgot to talk about them. I mean, we're looking at this attack that happened to at the Russian embassy, of which IS, Khorasan, or Daesh claim responsibility, okay? We know, obviously, Daesh does not like Iran. There was an attack on Iran's embassy a while ago in Herat, of which we don't really... there was condemnation from the Taliban government, but they really are responsible for the security of these embassies. And yet, you know, these two embassies have been targeted. What kind of relationship do you think exists between the Taliban and Daesh in Afghanistan? Is there one? Is there not? Are they on? What kind of terms are they, if there's any?
Well, I don't think they have a very good relationship. They have the same problem that that ISIS had with al-Nusra in Syria, which is that the Taliban want to govern their country. They want to have control over one place, which is their home. ISIS, on the other hand, claims to want to govern the world. They want to change the world and control the activities there. So they really don't have a common platform other than the fact that they have a similar sort of religious underpinning, which makes them hostile, unfortunately, to Iran. However, I think the Taliban are probably a lesser problem than the ISIS, because ISIS is a threat to everywhere they go. And the fact that they have connections with U.S. intelligence and with other Western intelligence organizations, too, for instance, the British intelligence, is that they're a threat everywhere they go. They use them to start a war in Russia. They use them to cause problems in China. They use them everywhere to soften the ground, so to speak, when the U.S. wants to... to have control. So that's one thing. The Taliban, on the other hand, are a group of local guys that really want to have control in their own space. And they believe that they can manage that in a way that will be okay for the people. So in some ways, they actually have parallels with the people who in Iran who had the revolution, which is that they come across a country that's been influenced from the outside, not to its best interest, over a long period of time, and they want to regain control within their country.
Very well. Last question to you, Ken Stone, quickly if you can. The SCO, Secretary General, recently said there's an increase in these militants or terrorists that are arriving in northern Afghanistan, and he said that the leaders are actively interacting with the leaders of other terrorist organizations. Now, by the process of elimination, which country do you think that that they may be talking about? What terrorist organizations? From which country?
I can only guess which terrorist organizations you're referring to. However, the main controller of all these terrorist organizations are the U.S. and the U.K. And their game is very clear. At a time when the world is facing multiple health crises and an environmental crisis, these countries are stirring up trouble everywhere in the world.
You. Appreciate it, Ken Stone. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Ken Stone from Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Judith Pello, a pleasure. Thank you so much. Senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement from Rochester. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Recovery Talkway and the team. It's goodbye. Until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson avoiding excessive harshness and bad language in the Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the third condition of calling for good and forbidding evil in the Islamic lifestyle, and that is avoiding excessive harshness and bad language when you're performing such an obligation. In the Islamic lifestyle, it is said, in the Islamic teachings, it is said that a person, when he wants to call people towards good, he must call them with a nice tone. He must call them with love. And when he wants to stop them from performing evil, in stopping them, he must avoid excessive harshness and bad language. Why? Because Imam Hassan alayhi salam has said that al-ifratu fil malamati yashubbu niran al-lajaja, that when someone excessively blames someone or he wants to stop someone from performing bad deed, when he use a harsh, excessive harsh wordings, it raises the fire of not listening. It raises the fire of not listening to the parents or that person. So we must avoid the bad language, use of bad language. And this is not good. It is not according to the Islamic teachings. And a Muslim must avoid a bad language. It must avoid the excessive harshness, the harshness that would result into something else, that would result into the disputes, that will result into ignoring such a person and listening to such a person. Therefore, it is necessary to take care of all these things, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of avoiding the excessive harshness and the bad language in the Islamic lifestyle. And this is the third condition of calling for good and avoiding evil. Therefore, we must avoid all these things. Why? Because in the narrations we have that it is said that وَلَا تُكْثِرِ الْإِطَابَ فَإِنَّهُ يُورِثُ الْضَغِينَ, that you must stop and you must not exceed in blaming someone, because when we blame someone and if we exceed in blaming, this will result in the fight, this will result in making enemies, this will result that the person who we are blaming will not have any love or respect towards us. It will reduce, it will remove the respect of two ways. Therefore, when we want to perform the obligation of calling for good and forbidding evil, we must pay attention that we are respecting people, we are dealing with people with respect, we are talking to them nicely, we are trying to explain what they are doing, and we must bring the logic and the reasons for why we are stopping them and why they should stop from performing such an evil act and why they should perform the good deeds. But on the other hand, if we see there is someone who is not listening to us, who never has a respect for himself, then do not waste your time over there. Because after giving the logic and the reasons and everything, even after that, if someone is not listening, then obviously there is no need. Because Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said, "Man hanat alayhi nafsahu," whoever thinks that his self is has no value, "Fala tarju khayrahu," then there is no hope of reform in him. Why? Because he has degraded himself, and therefore there is no hope. Therefore, leave him on his own. But do not disrespect, do not use the bad language or harsh words for such person. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
You're listening to Husseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah al-Hussein. Brothers and sisters, I send my deep condolences for the time period of Muharram and for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We were talking about Ziyarat al-Ashura, and we were talking about how to benefit from Ziyarat al-Ashura and to make this a spiritual journey for us. We talked about the first station, which is the station of Bala. And we understand that Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wa salam, they dealt with this Bala in the best way. And they submitted to the will of God. Second, we talked about grief and huzn. And that we should share the grief and huzn of the Ahlul Bayt. And it gives us a very high station, and it gives us a very high status. Third, we talked about reaching the position of silm, peace, and lan, or harb, with the enemies of Imam Hussein. Meaning that we separate ourselves from the enemies of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, and we take ourselves fully to the camp of Imam Hussein. We take our mind, body, soul, Everything we do, everything we think about, everything that's in our heart, we align it with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When we talk about aligning ourselves with Imam Hussein, it doesn't only mean about us. Allah has given us an obligation, which according to the narration, all other obligations can be like a drop of water compared to this ocean. What is this obligation? It is the obligation of enjoining the good, of forbidding the evil, of not only thinking about myself, about thinking about others, trying to help others. If somebody is in harm in this world, do you only care about yourself? Or do you try to make others stay away from harm? Do you try to help others out? So this is the basic philosophy behind Amr bil Ma'ruf wa An-Nahi Anil Munkar, which is enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. When we look at some of the letters that Imam Hussein alayhi salam has and some of the statements he had, he gives the entire purpose of why he uprose. He says that, وَإِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لِطَلَبِ الْإِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي. I moved out solely to seek to rectify the affairs of the ummah of my grandfather. أُرِيدُ أَنْ أَمُرَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَأَنْهَى عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. My purpose is to enjoin good and forbid evil. So therefore, he wants to rectify, he wants to make good the deviation, the distortion that happened to the ummah, to the nation of the Prophet after he passed away. And he wants to enjoin the good. So this is one of the key reasons that he uprose. That he just didn't care about himself, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He cared about the ummah. And he sacrificed himself. And with his holy blood, the ummah was awakened. At that time, and even today, about 1400 years after this tragic event. When we look at some of the narrations, in Al-Kafi, there's a very deep narration about enjoining the good. It talks about Imam Baghir alayhi salam, and this narration talks about a group of people that come at the end of time. They might pray, they might fast, as long as it doesn't hurt them or doesn't harm them too much. But they leave Amr bil Ma'ruf, Al-Amr bil Ma'ruf, Wal-Nahy Al-Munkar. They leave this important obligation. What happens to such people in the narration? In such a narration, it says that in such case, the anger of Allah will be upon them. هُنَالِكَ يَتِمُّ غَضَبُ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَ عَلَيْهِمْ. Even they're praying, they're fasting, they might be doing other obligations. But they are not enjoining the good. At the end of the narration, it talks about that to the people of Shu'aib, that God sends to Shu'aib in this narration, that I'm going to chastise 100,000 people. 40,000 of them are evil, 60,000 of them are good. And Prophet Shu'aib is surprised. He says, are you going to punish the good people? And then Allah says in the narration that, why dahanu ahl al-ma'asi? They stopped giving good advice to the sinners. Walam yaghbadu لغذبي. And they did not become anger because of my anger. Meaning that they did not take serious those things that I've made haram. They did not take serious those things that I've made wajib for others. And because of this, the good and evil together they perished. Therefore, we have this important obligation not only to make ourselves enter the camp and tent of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but to help others so that they can reach, inshallah, the camp and tent of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry while infant children die. Hussein said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave.
We were talking about enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Now, there are conditions for us that before we enjoin the good, that we should be aware of. One of those conditions is that we should have knowledge. You should make sure that this thing that you're going to tell somebody is halal or haram, that you're certain about it. Maybe according to a jurist, the way that, for example, some parts of discrepancies, that some of the jurists' minor discrepancies they have, some of them the jurists might allow, for example, a condition in salat, in prayer, or another invalidator in fast is not invalid for them. You have to make sure according to their jurist, according to the scholar they follow, and the knowledge that you have is certain that this is haram for them before you enjoin the good. Two, we should make sure that we are looking at a good method. Because many people, they think that, okay, now that I'm going to enjoin the good, it's sufficient for me just to tell them, hey, this is haram, or hey, this is halal, or this is wajib. But that is not sufficient. Amr ma'ruf and nahy al-munkar means you're taking them with kindness, with affection. You're taking them and helping them out, just like you'd help somebody else out. You won't do it with angrily. You won't do it in a bad mood. You would do it in a very pleasant way. And you have to think of the best methodology sometimes to help people out. Maybe sometimes indirectly. You talk about something, you know, you don't have to tell them directly. You say indirectly, you know, this was a sin. I read this in this book. And the person says, oh, wow, I didn't know. I didn't know this certain action was haram. So, or I didn't really know that it was this big of a sin for me. So the method that we choose is very important. Sometimes we can push people away more from Islam. If you don't choose the appropriate methodology, and always start with the most important things, like helping them with salat, helping them with fasting, helping them with those important tenets and pillars of Islam that are the most important. Third of all, some people might have a lot of sins, or they might be indulged in sin, and you think that, oh, it's not going to have any effect. Maybe you could take away one action, help take away one action that they do, one bad habit that they have. You don't necessarily have to change completely, expect to completely change, or maybe from, say, 100 things, 10 of them, you can help them out with. And fourth of all is when and where to say. Sometimes in front of everybody, you don't have to embarrass somebody. You can take them privately and talk to them and say, brother or sister, I'm very concerned for you. I'm worried about you. As you know, I'm doing this out of love for you. Or some of the family members come together, or some of the friends, and say, you know, what's going on? Let's see what's happening. And you talk with them in a very good way, in an appropriate place, an appropriate time, and of course, in the appropriate manner. So that we can, inshallah, be of those that fulfill this important obligation, which is Amr Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar. And we link ourselves to the movement of Imam Hussein, which is a movement of enjoining the good.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Growing up in poverty is among the many things distinguishing presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva from his opponents. The difficulties he and his family faced from a young age undoubtedly influenced his policymaking during his government. The former president's cousin took us to visit the small clay house Lula lived in until he was seven. located in the rural area outside of Garanhuns in the northeastern state of Pernambuco.
Esse casebrezinho aqui construído de forma muito singelo.
So the shack next door here, which built in a very simple way, was once the home of our president Lula, along with his mother, his father, and his seven brothers and sisters before he emigrated to São Paulo, naturally to save of hunger.
Conditions in this part of the countryside were difficult. There was no running water, and it was only around 2006, under Lula's presidency, that rainwater collection systems were built in this and many other communities.
In 1952, I would have to go out to get water. I had to go 18 kilometers on a donkey to get 4 jugs of water every morning. I'd leave at 2 or 3 in the morning and would be gone until 6 or 7 a.m. with the 4 containers of water, with the donkeys all dying of thirst.
Despite the Workers' Party's advances on economic rights, poverty alleviation, eradicating hunger, and in bridging inequality generally, conditions are now deteriorating under the neoliberal government of Jair Bolsonaro.
Today we live in a similar fashion, but things improved after Lula became president. Every house around here that didn't have a rainwater cistern has 2 of them now, and that has helped the people a lot to be able to work. It helped against poverty. Through the banks, it gave credit to poor people, and that is how Brazil got better. And now with Bolsonaro, things are getting as bad as back in 1952, when Lula left this area.
It's candidate Lula da Silva, who many working-class Brazilians are saying they identify with most. Camila Escalante, Pernambuco.
Finally, after weeks of divisive debates and bitter infighting, Britain's ruling Conservative Party has elected a new leader, Liz Truss, who also goes on to become the next Prime Minister, ending a power vacuum at number 10, which led to public fear and economic uncertainty. Truss was officially appointed after meeting Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Tuesday morning. Her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had earlier issued his final speech outside number 10 ahead of resigning his post.
This is it, folks. Thank you, everybody, for coming out so early this morning. In only a couple of hours, I will be in Balmoral to see Her Majesty the Queen. And the torch will finally be passed to a new Conservative leader.
Truss has secured the faith of the Tory membership. However, polling suggests the Conservatives have lost favour with the wider electorate. But Truss supporters believe she has what it takes to turn things around.
Liz Truss wasn't responsible for the mess that the country is now in. Indeed, Rishi Sunak, her rival as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was behind many of the policies which involved an increase in the national insurance, basically a tax on jobs, and, of course, inflationary policies that have exacerbated the crisis that Britain is currently in. So Liz Truss will be a new broom that will come in and perhaps sweep up the mess that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, her predecessor as Prime Minister, created.
Allegations have been spread of a possible plan by Boris on returning to power, agitating from the backbenches to undermine Truss's leadership, as he did under David Cameron and Theresa May.
Boris Johnson, to be honest, I met him and he is like unpredictable. He can do anything. I think at the moment he will be away for a while, but he must have a plan. Always he have a plan. Boris, he like stay for a little while, then he have something else. So he's not going to stop for sure.
Truss's first big challenge will be dealing with the cost of living crisis. She's pledged a clear plan within a week, with expectations of a cap freeze on energy bills. But winter looms and bills remain eye-wateringly high.
Even before Truss took office, speculation has swirled regarding whether she has what it takes or not to save the economy, fight off backbench criticism, and also to hold on to power for the Conservatives in a general election, the next being scheduled for January 2025, meaning that Truss will have to make a meaningful impact and quickly in order to hold on to her position at number 10 for the long term. Robert Carter, London.
The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021 brought about rapid and momentous changes to the country's economy. which was already reeling under the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, persistent insecurity, and weakened private sector confidence. Following the power shift, the war-torn country's economic activities were greatly affected, with the private sector being hit hard. Many private firms have experienced a drastic decline in consumer demand for their products and services. A survey by the World Bank shows that many firms in Afghanistan are adjusting to the new business environment, but most are still facing daunting challenges. The majority of private firms have responded to those challenges by laying off employees, shifting to cash and informal payment channels, shrinking investments, and lowering staff salaries.
Today, factories are facing a lot of problems, especially with raw materials, oil, and power. In our factory, we did our best to continue work. However, we were forced to reduce the number of our employees from 120 to 60. We also made some changes to salaries. We're trying to survive at any cost in this harsh situation so that we can help some people put food on their tables and make ends meet.
The survey has also found that employment remained around 50% lower than before August 2021. Most firms are operating below their full capacity and are only considered partially open. This, as U.S. sanctions have disrupted international payments and limited access to bank accounts and formal banking.
The biggest challenges the Afghan private sector is facing are the new government's unrecognized status and banking problems. You know that Afghanistan is importing raw materials from abroad, but today our business people are unable to transfer their money. The cruel sanctions are not posing any pressure on the ruling Taliban, but on the private firms and the welfare of our people. Our country needs to be considered as a member of the global village once again and start interacting with the world.
In the meantime, the new survey confirms the resilience of Afghanistan's private sector, which can play a key role in the economic recovery of the country and improving the livelihood of the Afghan people. Private sector firms in Afghanistan are impacted by the loss of international assistance and banking relationships. Business people here are calling for positive cooperation between the Taliban and global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the Port of Hodeidah. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in the decision posed on the Yemeni people because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN brokered agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister. beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. Indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party. Lagging in the polls and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects. Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that a price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza.